Movie Buff Specialist Phil and John are back as we continue making our way through our favorite 100 movies of all time. Tonight, we're up to number 33, and now we can officially say that we are two-thirds done with this podcast. It's episode 68. We're almost done. It really is starting to feel that way. We watched two movies this week. Wasn't surprised to see Blair Witch super high on John's list. Taxi Driver, John, I know that'll lead to a pretty interesting discussion, but... Yeah, I said it last week. It's kind of now at the point where, like, you're really getting to movies where it's like, even if you don't like it, it's like what you experienced this week. It's like, but you see the value in it. And those movies are sometimes harder to rank than anything else because, I don't know, now it's like, okay, am I enjoying this? I don't really think so, or maybe I am, but I still feel like there's enough merit that it's not like a Lady in the Water, you know, half star movie. So what do you do? Yeah. Now, I'm not saying about Blair Witch. Blair Witch is one of my favorite horror movies of all time. But I know that John had an interesting watch of Taxi Driver. And after he gave it its review and then texted me his actual thoughts, and I went and looked at his review, I was like, but you gave it 3.5 stars, my friend. What the hell's going on here? So this will be an interesting discussion when we talk about it. These are two very popular movies.
Yes.
For very different reasons. And they're both kind of cult hits at this point. I think it's interesting. I think they're both, yeah. I think they could both be classified that way.
Yeah, I would think so. Neither, like, both of them had kind of like their heyday where they were like incredibly popular, but they've kind of simmered down since then. Mm-hmm. And they more lie in the recesses of people who remember them at this point. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Taxi Driver's, so Blair Witch obviously like, creates an entire genre with the found footage film and all that. And we'll talk about this when we actually discuss the movie, because this was all anybody, I was 7 years old when this came out, and it's all anybody talked about. Like, it was wild when this came out. But Taxi Driver is an interesting one because it is very mid 70s. It is very like, we are depressed, we are miserable, Vietnam's over, and we all hate each other, and what are we going to do? Like, it is very reminiscent of America in the 70s. But it was popular, but not super popular. Scorsese doesn't get a Oscar nomination for director for this movie. Mm-hmm. That doesn't come until Raging Bull. And then it only gets 4 Oscar nominations. It comes out in a popular with a year with a lot of popular movies, with Network and Rocky and All the President's Men. And then Raging Bull comes, and Scorsese makes Goodfellas in the early 90s. And now all of a sudden, these are the movies that Scorsese is being known for. And Taxi Driver kind of goes unnoticed. And then when IMDb starts coming around and they start doing their top 250 and stuff, Taxi Driver starts to take off again, because now people are saying, well, what's that Scorsese movie? And that's where I think it's become a little bit of a cult movie, because everybody knows the "you talking to me" thing. And a lot of people know, like, the image of Travis Bickle with the Vietnam jacket on, and he's got the mohawk. Like, everybody knows that image. But this is not the most popular of Scorsese's movies, and I would argue that it's one of the hardest ones of his classics, air quotes on classics, because some of those I don't believe are classics, but I would say it's the hardest one to actually get people invested in. It's really one of the earlier Hollywood art movies, in my opinion.
Yeah, I would say so. From like the direction standpoint, it's quite a beautifully shot movie. I really enjoy, like, I like the bookends that we get with, like, the use of the police lights at the beginning and the end. It really helps set the tone for the film, I felt. And it's just a little hard. It's really hard to explain how I felt watching this movie, because I'm sitting there, I am recognizing why it's a good movie, I'm recognizing why people would enjoy this movie, but I'm just not connecting with it in any way. And that's why, like, this 3.5 rating I gave it was like, I recognize this as a very good movie. Mm-hmm. But it's just not one of those movies that's blowing me out of the water. And it kind of felt like, and I feel like that's where it falls into this cult, like the cult realm, is because there are just a lot of people who are not going to connect with this movie.
Yeah, I mean, this is a weird one too, because you have to go along for the ride the entire time. Mm-hmm. And That's not necessarily the case with other Scorsese movies. Like Goodfellas is a gangster movie and Raging Bull, definitely an art movie, but it's a boxing movie. And you can kind of get behind that. Like with this movie, there's really nothing likable about Travis Bickle. However, Scorsese does do a good job of, and Paul Schrader, who wrote the screenplay, which I don't think he ever really did anything good again, because I know he did First Reformed and I didn't like that movie. He does a great job. Like, it's funny, Paul Schrader wasn't nominated for the Oscar for this. I'm just going to say that. This doesn't get nominated for screenplay, which to me is mind-blowing because he toes that line so well. There's almost nothing to like about Travis Bickle. He's not even – I don't even know if you could call him an anti-hero. Like, people enjoy watching Walter White do things because Walter White, at the end of the day, has a family and there's something human about him. Travis Bickle, though, becomes more of a hero – just because of how terrible everything around him is, which is what is so fascinating. He's got the pimps, the 12 and a half year old girl who's a prostitute. He's got all of the drugs and all of the people who the other taxi drivers are not good people. Like they're bad people. Like you see that he is just in this underbelly. And the one thing that kind of makes him, you root for him a little bit, is that he was a veteran. Like he just came back from Vietnam. He doesn't know what to do. He just needs to work long hours because he's got nothing. And you start to see just this descent into the madness that is whatever is around him in New York City in 1976.
Yeah. And I mean, maybe that's why I didn't connect with it as much, because like the patriotism of veterans isn't big here. Right. Like it's not big anywhere the way it is in the States. And like, so I'm not connecting on that, but like I'm sitting here watching this film and I see this greatly disturbed man. I mean, he's clearly suffering from like PTSD from his experience in Vietnam. And he's also feels just so grimy at the same time. Mm-hmm. Like he's a despicable human being who has this superiority complex and thinks he's better than absolutely everyone around him. Mm-hmm. And it's so hard to root for a character like that, even in like this great performance from Robert De Niro in this role, even though it's written so well, directed so well, it doesn't feel the same as the anti-heroes we get 20 years later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so what is hard, especially like, so this to me this is an American movie, but it's not an American movie in the way that like when we watched The Rules of the Game is a French movie. Like the Rules of the Game, like the first 45 minutes of that movie, if you don't know anything about French culture, you're kind of like, what the hell is this? See, Taxi Driver to me is an American movie, but it still resonates with just like that loner outsider mentality. It's not diving too much. And not for nothing, it's set in probably the most popular city in the entire world, in New York City. Yeah. I mean, so that also helps it for sure. But when I look at it, what I love to look at with 70s movies is how they handle Vietnam and how they handle veterans from Vietnam. Because out of all the wars that America's ever been involved in, it's the one that really nobody ever can say like what happened with Vietnam. There's a general consensus that it was obviously a disaster. Yeah. But beyond that, there are so many different sides to it. There's so many different stories. You have the veterans who tell their story. You have the people who were here who tell their story. You have the people who were too young, too old, all this stuff. There's so many different ways to look at what happened with Vietnam. And you see it like with The Deer Hunter. That's a Vietnam War movie. That's my favorite movie of all time. And we're going to get to that one. Apocalypse Now, which I talked about a couple weeks ago. That's another Vietnam War movie and how they handle that. Two completely different movies. Mm-hmm. And then Taxi Driver is another one that it's not a Vietnam War movie, but it's about a guy who was in the Marines and he's coming back. And like, you see kind of like these people went and fought for something and then they come back and they really don't know what to do. And nobody really gives a shit about what they should do. Nobody cares that Travis Bickle went and fought in the Marines. And this is still something you see a lot in America, people coming back from Afghanistan or Iraq and not knowing what to do. and coming back to towns and stuff that do not care that they were just there because they were living their lives, and good for you. You went and did it. Thanks for your service. Goodbye. And now how does that person react? How does a person who goes into a situation is maybe already mentally unstable, comes back to a place that doesn't have a place for him, and now just keeps going further and further into being more and more mentally unstable, because who's he hanging around with and what's he doing? There's no purpose. It feels like there's just no purpose for the lives here, where it's funny if you watch like a World War I, World War II movie dealing with the aftermath, it always feels like there's more of a purpose. You still see these same struggles and things like that, mm-hmm. but there was more of like everybody was at least behind you in some fashion. With this, nobody cares about Travis Bickle. And he goes in and he's talking about Palantine and he wants to volunteer and all that. And while Cybill Shepherd's character is obviously like an exaggeration and it's purposefully done that way to like, oh, she's naive, when in reality, like, she's not naive. But it's the Tom character played by Albert Brooks who just mm-hmm. doesn't trust him from the start. And Travis Bickle hates him. Literally sits there for half of their lunch just talking about how much he doesn't like that guy, because that guy, he gives me a weird feel. He doesn't, blah, blah, blah. Because that's the butting of heads. The guy who went and fought in the war and the guy who's sitting there behind a desk and feels like he has a purpose. Why does he get to have that? I love that dynamic. And I love what the 70s and these directors were doing, looking at Vietnam and looking at the mental psyche. And I really do believe that The Deer Hunter does it the best, and that's why it's my number one. But I do think that this and Apocalypse Now deal with this in the second best way, where it's like Apocalypse Now is while they're in it. This is when they get back from it. But just this descent of like, what else am I supposed to do?
Yeah, I mean, it's Scorsese does this fantastic job of focusing on the isolation that Travis is going through based on just not being able to connect with anyone. And we get to see it through his interactions with people. He doesn't have a single interaction with anyone in this film where you feel like there's any genuine connection there, mm-hmm. except maybe Jodie Foster's character mm-hmm. for like, and like that's a 12-year-old prostitute. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really important that that's the character he's connecting to, because what it's coming down to is Travis's mind just feels so juvenile in this film. He doesn't feel like a fully developed adult because it was probably stinted by him being in the Marines and going to Vietnam.
Yeah. Well, and also, though, the other thing is I think it gets into the protection and machismo mm-hmm. of everything. You know what I mean? Like, he needs to – he went and fought for his country. Now he has nothing to fight for. Well, now he meets Jodie Foster and sees her wasting away, and it's just projecting, projecting, projecting. You're doing nothing. What's wrong with you? Get out of here. Like, you're an idiot. When in reality, what's he doing? He's doing nothing too. But now he has found something to protect and something to give him purpose. And I agree with you. He is stunted because he can't connect with Cybill Shepherd. He takes her to the adult movie, and it's the most uncomfortable adult scene in any movie other than The Graduate, where Dustin Hoffman takes Catherine Ross to the whatever club. To me, this is so uncomfortable because he doesn't realize that he's doing something wrong. He just is that out of touch with everybody else. But when he starts talking to Jodie Foster, this is somebody who can't really challenge him, and he can protect and he can guide and he can tell what to do, because they're not going to look at him and say, well, this is your problem too, you're messed up, man, or anything like that. Whereas everybody else can look at him and say, there's something wrong with you. Jodie Foster needs him. And that's why he, I think, is able to so easily connect with her, and why she really is the turning point in the movie, and ultimately what leads to what I believe is one of the best ironic endings. It is the best ironic ending in film history. I mean, it really like captured that in a way that really no other movie's ever been able to do.
Okay, well, I'm going to challenge it right now. Did the ending happen?
Well, I think that's a great point. Because, I think it's like, a great point.
It just seems like so much this like wish fulfillment from Travis, from what he was attempting to do, that it seems too neat for what the rest of this movie is for Travis to come out a hero.
Well, and so this is the beauty of this movie, though. So first you have the basic, obvious, like was going to be the ultimate villain, was going to assassinate a presidential candidate, and then gets to go and be a hero and kill a pimp, and now he's the ultimate hero, and he gets to give his FU to Cybill Shepherd. The moment that, see, I do think that he kills Harvey Keitel. I think that happens.
I think that happens.
Then he goes in the house. Yeah. As soon as he gets shot by Harvey Keitel, that's where I think the rest of it, I think he dies on that couch, essentially.
I agree.
That's where it comes, in my opinion. So he still gets to be a hero, but is he actually being viewed as a hero in the grand scheme of things? Because if he died on that couch with everybody else, are they just going to look at him as another scumbag who is just involved in a prostitute pimp shooting?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly what I think. Go ahead. Sorry, I know you're coughing, so I didn't. I'll let you get it out.
No, that's exactly what I thought too. I was just like, it seems fine and realistic as, like, you know, a one man rampage through a decrepit building after being shot in the neck can be, until you get to the scene where it's reading the letter from Jodie Foster's parents, and then it's like, no, this is way too neat for this movie. This can't possibly have happened.
Yeah, and I think, you know what this ending kind of reminds me of, but in my opinion, a much more intelligent way, is it reminds me of Inception, where it really doesn't matter. Everybody was like, oh man, did the top fall? Did it not? It doesn't matter, because whose totem is that? And what difference does it make? And I feel like that is what this movie was doing, where Scorsese's like, if you want to look that far into it, go ahead. This is going to be the fantasy ending for Travis Bickle. This is going to be the ending that he gets, and maybe that he doesn't deserve, but that he feels he deserves. And now he gets to say up yours to the girl who blew him off because he took her to a dirty movie, and somehow that makes her the bad guy and not him. But I do agree with you. When he gets shot with all the blood and the violence and everything like that, and he's sitting on the couch and he just goes down, and that shot of just Jodie Foster curled up in the corner and all that, everything that happens after that moment, I think it's up to interpretation. I really do. I think, because for me, it's not even like, I don't even realize it with like the letters so much or anything like that. For me, it really is just the scene of her getting in the taxi and that whole conversation, all of that. Like, that to me is like the dying dream. You know what I mean? And he got his FU and then he died. Like, that's what it feels like to me. But again, kind of doing this at a time where that wasn't really the popular thing. I mean, there weren't forums and the internet and all this stuff to go and sit around and discuss, man, what was the ending of Taxi Driver all about? I mean, in 1976, yeah, people are going to talk about movies and they're going to dissect them and they're going to review and things like that. But you couldn't go on Reddit and after a movie was done on a Friday night, opening night, and go on there and see that 100 people had already posted what their thoughts were or something like that. And then you would get a, oh, maybe he was dead the whole time or something like that. You know, you see this all the time with movies. What is it? Ferris Bueller's now all of a sudden has it where he's dead the whole time. Like, it's all nonsense. But I think like that is like an extra special element of this movie that you weren't really getting back at that time. And that's where I just give it even more credit, because believe what you want to believe, but could something that positive really happen in this era of New York? I think Scorsese's telling you, no, it can't. But if it's going to happen to somebody, it's going to happen to this guy, or at least he's going to think it happened to him.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting because, well, you mentioned that like this is the ending that Travis feels he deserves. And that's like the biggest thing about this entire movie. And like the driving factor of this movie is everything is based off what Travis believes he deserves. Travis believes he deserves to not be lonely. He's talking about how all the, you know, the pimps and the prostitutes can all be in relationships, but he can't. That, like, the scum of the earth, as he puts it, are out getting into these relationships that he views he should be entitled, that he's entitled to as someone who, as a, like, self-proposed, he oozes that, like, nice guy type of feel, where, like, he just thinks he's the nicest guy ever, and doesn't realize how terrible he actually is. And he thinks he deserves something because of it. And that's where all his conversations with Cybill Shepherd get to, where it's just like, he feels he deserves to be in a relationship with that character. Like, Travis feels he deserves to be in that relationship. And that's why this film makes you feel uneasy throughout. Because as a someone who is a little more in tune with the way the world works, it feels scummy. Like, you know people like that. You know people who think they're the best person in the world and deserve everything. And it's creepy and it's uneasy being around them.
Well, I think too, how many times, and you know, now we have the privilege of a cell phone, but how many times when you sit down and you watch a scene in this movie, do you just want to like look away? Because you just know it's coming and you know it's uncomfortable. His initial conversation with Sybil Shepherd, he's so desperate. Their lunch conversation, when he goes back in to see her and he's doing that. Every conversation between him and Harvey Keitel is so uncomfortable. When he's talking to the president and you can see the president's like right-hand man, staff or whatever he is, just like being like, what the hell is wrong with this nut job? Like all of those things, you want to look away so many times when he's talking. I mean, to me, the most disturbing part of this entire movie, the most disturbing part is when he is talking to the Secret Service agent.
Yes.
That scene is, I really believe, and this is where I just can't believe, when I was looking this up and Paul Schrader wasn't nominated, I was like, what in the world were they looking for? That scene is one of the best written scenes ever. Throw out the rest of the movie and just look at that scene. And the way that both of those characters are playing each other and how Travis Bickle is losing his mind with the arms crossed and mimicking him. And then that turns into, you know, what kind of gun you use? You got a 357 of this. So that starts getting specific with it. Cause this is coming out on the heels of the Easy Eddie scene, which phenomenal scene. But this scene just nails all of that. And then, oh, well, if you give me your name and address, we can make sure that you become a Secret Service agent. Oh, okay. Well, my name's Henry. And now Travis Bickle is playing along with that guy. And that guy is almost taking for granted that Travis Bickle is that smart. And just to watch that play out, every moment of that is so cringeworthy. Everything. De Niro's demeanor, everything. And it just perfectly encapsulates way too many people that you know, that if you're a writer, most of the time you don't have the guts to actually sit down and write because it makes you too sick to your stomach and you're too embarrassed to even write the damn thing.
Exactly. It's a great observance on just like society as a whole. And like that idea of like that social isolation that so many people feel. And so many people feel the way to get out of it is by deserving a way out of it. Mm-hmm. I really like how Scorsese captures that sense of like social paranoia in the diner scene with all the taxi drivers. Mm-hmm. The amount of cuts in that scene is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And it just makes you feel uneasy because of how quickly you're shifting perspectives in that scene.
Yeah. Yeah, he just keeps going and going and going. And all of their personalities too, right? Like what they're talking about and the stuff that they're saying and all, like, it's so of the era. And it's just so of that. I mean, you're looking around and like, I love the cut around where when he goes into the one, can I get a cup of coffee? And they all leave and whatever. And he's looking around and you got all the pimps just sitting there staring at him. Like, what are you doing here? You know what? Like all of those things, like New York City, yeah, it still has its problems. I don't spend too much time there. But New York City used to be a scary place to go to if you weren't in the nicest parts of it. Like, it was not always what it's hyped up to be. And I agree with you. But that's where Scorsese was just on a different level. Like, there's such a voyeuristic element to this movie, too. A lot of this movie is Travis watching people and writing about it from his effed up perspective. And a lot of the stuff he's saying, you know what? It's like, hey, he's getting on to something, but then he takes it too far. And you're just like, oh, okay, this guy's weird. But think about the scene with Scorsese looking in the window and seeing his wife up there. And hey, that guy's been staring at us from his taxi for a long time. He's watching when Jodie Foster gets in the car and Harvey Keitel pulls her out. Like, there's so much voyeurism going on here. And it's those invisible people at that time. Everybody knew the pimps and the prostitutes and the politicians who were going to clean it up and the people in their suits and whatever. But nobody was paying attention to the taxi drivers. Nobody was paying attention to those guys because they didn't matter. And I mean, he actually does play the good guy at least at one part when he shoots and kills the guy who's robbing the store. I mean, there's at least that, yeah, right? Like there's one scene where he's a hero. So I don't know. It's just, it's a good observance though, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, even that scene though, is he shooting that person to, because he's robbing the store, or is he shooting that person because he can shoot that person?
He's shooting him because he can, he wants right? to do like, it. Like, because he could have just stood back there and let the store get robbed. But he, at that point, he has the bloodlust. But I do also think that that's the turning point, too, when he does that. That's when it's, yeah, I'm going to go kill the president. Like, I'm going to go kill Palin. He's already killed someone. Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, it's really interesting. Like I said, it's a well-made movie. It investigates everything so well. Sometimes a movie is just so dissonant to you, you just can't connect to it. And that's how I felt about it.
Mm-hmm. And that's fair. That's fair. I mean, look, there's a lot of really good movies out there that like aren't enjoyable to watch because they're just too depressing, or they're too dark, or they're too whatever. Like, there's a lot of good movies that you're just like, I don't need to see that ever again. I'll be good if I never watch that again. Or, you know, yep, I appreciate it. Moving on. Like, I don't need that in my life. Like, there's a lot of movies like that. You know, and for you, it seems that this is one of them. One thing, you know, as we come up on the half hour here, De Niro's performance in this is so unreal. And you have to think about like the craziest part of this. So he was in Mean Streets, and, you know, he's in a couple movies before that. But really, obviously, The Godfather Part Two is when he like launched.
Yeah.
I mean, in a 6-year span, he did The Godfather Part Two, Taxi Driver, The Deer Hunter, and Raging Bull. And like, just to think that like he hopped on the scene as quickly as he did, and just like it launched such a long career that was just full of like iconic performances. I mean, then you get into The Untouchables and Goodfellas. And I just watched Awakenings a couple weeks ago, and he's absolutely phenomenal in that. Cape Fear, A Bronx Tale. If you haven't seen This Boy's Life, he's totally disturbing. Casino, like it just kept going on and on. And it's so crazy to see like that consistency for somebody, especially right at the beginning. You know what I mean? And like taking lead roles too. Obviously in The Godfather Part Two, he's not the lead. But to get in there and just take like, well, The Godfather Part Two, Pacino's the lead. I mean, he's essentially, it's two movies and there's two leads. But, you know, De Niro in Taxi Driver and especially in Raging Bull, he carries them so much. They're all about him. The Deer Hunter he does, but there's a lot of characters in that one. I don't know. It's just unreal to think that this was really his second big known movie. Role.
Yeah.
And he's taking on this thing after winning an Oscar and maybe the greatest supporting acting performance of all time. He wins that Oscar and then he turns around and he comes back and does this crazy weird ass movie with Martin Scorsese. And it just launched them into like stardom essentially.
Yeah. It kind of goes to show that if you got the chops, then you just find the people you want to work with and you keep doing it, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's the best way to put it. Also, did you notice how many times is Martin Scorsese in this movie, John?
I didn't realize he was in it at all because I didn't know what Scorsese looked like back then.
Oh, well, now you know. So Scorsese's actually in this movie twice. So he is the one who's in the back seat of the taxi, which, you know, is a famous director cameo. He's also in it the first time that Travis Bickle, when Cybill Shepherd walks by to go in the office, Scorsese is sitting right behind her and just watching her walk in. It's very funny. Yeah. This time watching was the first time I actually noticed that he was in it another time, but I like to think of the idea that like that guy was just hanging out there. And then, you know, like 3 nights later, he's like, I need to kill my wife. you know, like I like to think of that, you know? But anyway, all right, John, anything else you want to say about Taxi Driver?
No, I think we covered everything that I had.
Cool. All right. What was the best movie you watched this week?
Well, after we talked about it last week, I ended up watching Ty West's The House of the Devil. And boy, oh boy, that is a different level of horror movie, I tell you.
How crazy is the last 15 minutes of that movie?
And the fact that it's just such a slow burn until that last 15 minutes where almost nothing happens for the rest of the movie. It leaves you so unsettled the entire time. It's phenomenal. The decision to film it on 16mm and just like shoot it like an 80s movie. Absolutely genius. You're watching it and like you sit down, you turn it on And you're just like, this feels weird. And then you have that realization. It's like, oh, they're filming this like an 80s movie. Mm-hmm. That's why it feels this way. And it was just so unsettling the entire time. It's a wonderful hour and a half.
Yeah, it is. I love this movie. One of my favorite horror movies of all time. Would be fun at one point to like really list out like what are my favorite horror movies of all time. You know what I mean? And this is certainly one of them. I love it. And it is, you know, I was talking about with Halloween, there's so much walking and nothing really happening. Yeah. This movie is so much walking and pointless dance scenes and whatever, but it just feels, it is capturing that era so well, yet it's still made in 2009. And the last 15 minutes are some of the most terrifying moments in movie history you will ever see.
Yeah.
That one face literally ruined, like, every time I watch that movie, I almost forget how terrifying it is. And I remember the first time I watched it, that ruined my night. I watched that at like, that movie ended at like 1:15 in the morning for me. And I just remember like laying in my bed in LA and being like, I hate everything right now. Like I am miserable. Yeah. So it's a great movie. Great movie. I look forward to October so I can sit down and watch it, you know, but yeah, I do want to give a quick shout out to Vera Diana, the Louis Buñuel movie. It's been on my list for a while because it was on Letterboxd, like top 200 movies. And I watched it today before doing this podcast. I really didn't think I was going to like it. And oh my God, the last half hour of that movie is just something else. And the movie just keeps building and subverting expectations. And it really is an enjoyable watch. But I did watch Tokyo Story this week, finally. I now feel like I'm no longer a fraud. Like, this is a big deal. Like, I understand that you have Stalker at number one, but like, I don't feel bad not watching like the best Russian movies. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But like, to not watch what is considered the greatest Japanese movie, that's a different story. And so, I'm glad that I finally got to sit down and watch this. Just a fantastic movie. I mean, let's be real. It is perfection from start to finish. I was surprised how long they actually spend in Tokyo. I thought that it was going to be much more of like a 50-50 thing. It's definitely more of like an 80-20, but that was 1950s, man. You could take your time and nobody was going to get mad at you. And you know, Ozu did. And I love it. I love the feel of it. The score is freaking beautiful. And it just breaks your heart the entire movie because you just know something bad is going to happen. And it's a great look at relationships between parents and kids and moving away. And what's cool to me is like, you see this movie in 1953, obviously post World War II Japan, when Tokyo was building up and all the kids were looking for something to do. But think about how much more relevant this is kind of becoming now, because people are moving so far away. I mean, in the 50s, people still weren't really moving away. Like, you could still grow up and live in a town for your entire life. To have all your kids move away was also especially weird. But you think about it now, like, people will go year or more without seeing their parents or their direct family or something like that, because everybody's just moving away. Whereas that wasn't always the case. And I just think like, it's a fascinating look, and to see it 70 years later is fascinating. And it certainly stands the test of time, and good for it for being as good and for living up to the hype, because I'd been putting that one off for a little while.
Yeah. It was an absolutely beautiful experience that I don't even think we could really do it justice explaining that movie. It's one of those ones where you just have to experience it yourself. Take the 2.5 hours. It's heart-wrenching. It's devastating, but it's all so worth it.
Yep, absolutely. And if you're talking about, like, I always say, like, if you're talking about, like, what's the greatest movie of all time, when people talk about, like, Citizen Kane, or is it The Godfather, or is it Casablanca, I always go with Casablanca out of those three, mainly because I'm just like, I might like The Godfather more. I might like Casablanca more. It's up to, I don't really know. But like, Casablanca to me feels like it just captures everything a movie is supposed to be. Yeah. And then as years have gone on, Tokyo Story has started to creep into this conversation. When you start to look at world cinema and put it in with American cinema, it creeps into this conversation of, could it be the best movie of all time? And I just think about how that movie resonates as compared to something like Citizen Kane or something like that. It's a timeless movie. Mm-hmm. And a timeless movie set in post-war Tokyo, and then has some of it set in just a farm village or a fishing village, it's a hard thing to pull off.
Yeah, it is. I think the British Film Institute has it at number 3 currently, if I remember correctly.
I'll look up the BFI top 100.
I'm pretty sure the BFI top one, like the top 3, I think, is Vertigo, Citizen Kane,
Tokyo Story. And then The Rules of the Game, as funny as that
is. So yeah,
I guess everybody who voted on this is French and they understood the whole movie.
Yeah,
that's all I got. Sorry, yeah. Now you got me looking at this, and I'm not going to listen to you when you explain why you wanted to put this other movie, whatever it's called, the Blair. What is it? Yeah, why you wanted to put that one in your top? Although I want to just throw this out there: the fact that number five on this list is Sunrise, A Song of Two Humans. If you haven't seen Sunrise, A Song of Two Humans, watch it. It's top five silent movie ever made. I know that might not feel like it's saying much. God, it is so good. But anyway, all right, John, why do you got the Blair Witch Project? What's going on?
Okay, so there are a lot of things that I take into consideration when it comes to the Blair Witch Project. First off, this movie is just timeless for me. It's one of those things that the first time I saw it, I was on a school trip. There were like 12 of us in a hotel room. This is like not the nicest hotel. This is a time when like hotels still had like VHSs lining the walls of the hallways that you could rent. And Blair Witch Project was one of them. And so 12 of us just like sat in the room, turned off the lights and watched this movie for the first time. This would have been like 2006, I think. So, yeah, it left an impression and it's just one that I always revisit. I've probably seen this movie almost more than any other movie in all honesty, because it is just like an 80 minute watch. It's so innovative. Like it doesn't seem like it now because like the found footage genre has just it just exploded so much in like the late aughts, but this movie and specifically like the way this movie was marketed are just it's on another level when it comes to horror films. A lot of people credit like Scream for the revitalization of the horror genre. It was the Blair Witch Project. Like the Blair Witch Project is the reason why we had the horror genre come back full force in the aughts in the last 20 years.
Yeah. So I have a couple things to say on this, as I also, just so everybody knows, purchased Once Upon a Time in the West next week so I can watch it. But I have a couple things to say about this with the Blair Witch Project. The Blair Witch Project single-handedly created the worst genre in film history. Like it single-handedly did. Found footage film is the worst genre in film history. It is horrible. Everything that's made is bad, like with the exception of like maybe six or seven movies. Like every now and then you'll get a gimmick that works. Like Chronicle worked, Paranormal Activity, maybe the first one worked. I personally hated it the whole time. As Above, So Below was kind of an interesting look at this. But found footage, everything was going to be the next Blair Witch. And Paranormal Activity really was. Like good for Paranormal Activity for pulling that off. But the amazing part about the Blair Witch Project. So I didn't see this movie. I'm with you. I didn't see this movie until I was probably like 15, 16, 17, 18, somewhere like that. Because this came out in 99. I was 7 years old. My dad is a
too young to watch it at that point. Yeah.
Well, my dad's a huge horror fan and he hated it. Like just despised this movie. Wow. Well, because it's just, it's not the horror that he wants to see. Because at the end of the day, if you don't get into the psychological, if you don't buy in, this movie's not scary at all. If you don't buy into this movie, but that's any horror movie. Like if you don't buy into the fear they're selling you, then it's not scary. See, for me, first of all, greatest marketing ad campaign in the history of film. And that is not an exaggeration. Like I know I say this a lot and I just talked about how the Schrader scene and all that, but it is, there is nothing that comes close. This is a $50,000 movie that went on to make what, $120 million or something like that. Like it is one of the most absurd stories in film history for the amount of money this movie made with how little they put into it. Because all they did was go out and film an idea and say, okay, all of these people are really dead. And we're just gonna market it that way. The one guy was like on the Yankees farm team. And they were putting it out there that like the New York Yankees had lost a prospect because of this. Like he really was on the New York Yankees farm team. And like this was like all of these little side stories, they literally like marketed this as if we really found the footage. And like I was just saying with Taxi Driver, this was at a time where you couldn't just go verify. You couldn't just go on real quick and do a quick Google search and see, oh, no, all these people are really alive. Like Heather Donahue is hanging out in a freaking bar right now in Baltimore. Like, it's not a big deal. You couldn't do that. And that increased the fear so much because now people are sitting there going, holy shit, this really happened. if you can't really get into that mindset, this movie might not scare you very much. But that's why it was so monumental at the time, and why I think it is absolutely one of the all-time horror classics. Like, this for me is a classic the way Psycho is a classic, the way The Shining is a classic, the way The Exorcist is a classic, the way Halloween is a classic. Even though I don't love Halloween, this belongs in that tier, because it redefined a genre. As you said, it revitalized a genre, and it really did change the way people went out and made movies. Now it was, okay, if we go make a $200,000 movie, even if it's absolute shit, can we make $10 million on it? Because if we can, let's go. And go look at what they're doing with the Marvel movies and stuff. Where's the creativity in this stuff? It's not there. Think about the creativity that Myrick and Sanchez had when they went out and made this movie. It's unbelievable. Watch the behind the scenes of this. Explore what this movie was all about. It's 23 years old now. It might feel dated to you if you sit down and watch this. Go look into this movie. If you're young, if you're 18, 19, 17, whatever the hell. I don't know if I'm allowed to tell you to go watch this movie if you're 12, but go watch it, because honestly, screw it. If you're young and you're watching this for the first time, or you don't really understand what's going on, research what was going on with this movie after you watch it or before you watch it, and your appreciation for it will just grow. This is a cinephile's dream horror movie, and that's why it's so high on your list. And that's why every time I watch, I just sit there and smile the whole time, because I'm like, they made this freaking movie.
Yeah, it's so enjoyable. And like, even for us who were 7 years old when this movie came out, like, the marketing for this movie was so big. Like, I can remember it all. Like, I was seven. I don't remember like anything from when I was seven, but I remember how big the Blair Witch Project was.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's just so memorable, and it just gives you that great feeling where it's like, yeah, I have a lot of personal memories tied up with the movie as well, but it's a movie that you just watch and you're think about like the basic construction they put into this movie. We're first introduced at the very beginning of the movie, we get the title card saying that, you know, they found this footage, whatever, and then the first thing we get, two shots establishing the two types of camera views we're going to use for the entire movie.
Yep, that's it.
That's it. And they tell you right away. And then all the scenes interviewing the people in Burkittsville, all the stories, they're outlandish. They're crazy. None of them are the same. None of them corroborate each other. And that's what leads to the horror of it. Because it's like, okay, there are little pieces of each of it that come into play throughout the film. And that's why this movie is scary. This is the perfect example of how horror movies are more scary when you don't see what's going on.
Yeah. Well, and that's where I always say that, you know, horror becomes not scary when you know too much information. Like, what is, you know, living in America, mass shootings. What's so scary about a mass shooting? Other than the fact, obviously, that people are dead, but it's what's the motivation behind this monster? And that's terrifying to think about, because you could be walking through a mall and somebody just says, you know, I'm going to kill people today. And there is no real motivation to that. There's no purpose. There's no reasoning behind that. And that's obviously real life horror. And that's an extreme example, but that's where horror is at its best in film and in, you know, any other medium, is when you don't know what's going on because there's no rhyme or reason. You know, I always think about the Spielberg movie Duel. I don't know if you've seen Duel. That was his first movie, the made-for-TV movie. What's creepy about that movie is it's literally just a truck terrorizing this poor guy on the road. There's no rhyme or reason. The no rhyme or reason is the scariest thing. Serial killers are scary because why did Ted Bundy want to murder women? What was the point? You try to sit there and dissect everything. That's the fascination, but that's also the fear. And something like the Blair Witch Project, those first 25 minutes are freaking awesome, because it's just setting up this mythology. And you don't, like, it doesn't feel like those are actors. None of them are good looking. They're all like, they all look like they're just from Burkittsville. It looks like Merrick and Sanchez just walked up to them and said, here's what you need to say. Can you just say it like a normal person would say it? And that's all they're doing. And the little girl saying, no, don't say it. Starts crying and everything. It feels so real. You yeah. really feel like you're watching the footage from a documentary. And that's just like, that's so hard to do. And it's so impressive. And it just builds on that fear and it builds on everything. So that when they get out there, it's like when they find the teeth, it's like, wow, that's what they were talking about earlier, where they were taking the kids' teeth. Like, it's horrifying.
Yeah. It's the amount of foreshadowing in this movie is, it's wild how much forethought is put into absolutely everything in this movie. Cause like, all the payoffs we get at the end of the film, everything was foreshadowed by the conversations with these people in Burkittsville. And mm-hmm. we have everyone, we have the three people, we have Heather, Josh, and Mike laughing about these stories that these people are telling. Like, you get the impression that these three don't even believe this witch, that they are like, that this, there's any possibility this witch exists.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, we as an audience are never told if the witch exists.
Yeah.
And that's what's so beautiful about it, because even at the very end of this movie, with the way they're killed, that's based on the guy who was killing children up there. That's not the Blair Witch.
Yeah.
So what is happening in these woods? There was a 2017 sequel, don't watch it.
There's another sequel that came out long before that. Don't watch that one either. Oh,
please do not watch The Book of Shadows. That movie is very bad.
At least that's not even a real sequel, is it?
That wasn't a found footage movie. That was a like actual movie. And I've watched it. It's bad.
Yeah,
it's horrible. But I mean, at least like the newer one, it adds to the mythology, it just makes things a little weird. So it kind of ruins a little of the magic of this one, but in the end, there's so many different things happening to these people. You can't pinpoint why it's happening. Like, there are escalation points in the movie, and I think that's the biggest thing that this movie does well. The pacing of the escalation of events in this film is top-notch. It's almost incomparable. There are very few movies that can escalate as perfectly paced as this movie does.
Yeah, what's funny to me is like one of the biggest complaints about this movie, aside from the fact that people need to take Dramamine to not vomit while watching it, was that the characters just irritated them. What I love about this movie is that to me, this feels like how people would really react if they were lost in the woods and they felt like they were being screwed over, because they don't really all know each other that well. I think that's the thing that kind of goes missed on a lot of viewers. Like, they're all kind of just thrown together because they're making a film school project. And they're trusting Heather. And Heather doesn't really know what the hell is going on. And them screaming at each other and egging each other on and pushing each other to their breaking points, it just feels so authentic to me.
Yeah.
And yeah, they scream so loud sometimes that it hurts your eardrums because it makes everything peak and pop and all that fun stuff. But it's just so real. And it's funny when that's a complaint, because I'm like, no, that's like the best part about the movie, is like you feel their panic and their fear, and you can tell that the intensity is ramping up for them because they realize they're going to die out there. Mm-hmm. And now, like, just how are they going to die? Like, that becomes the question. And I think it's one of the best parts of the movie.
Yeah, it's that mystery and the suspense of what's going to happen, because you hear the first night we don't hear anything. We have Josh explain he thought he heard cackling. It's like, mm-hmm. whatever. Okay, sure you did, Josh. And then they find like the Indian burial ground and they knock over the rocks. And then you start hearing like the crashing in the woods. It's like, okay, what's causing the crashing? You know, with my experience living in the middle of nowhere and like mm-hmm. having a wooded area around my house, when I hear crashing in the woods, I assume it's a bear. I don't go outside.
Yeah, yeah.
But then you get more and more. And then there's children. My God, those children sounds when the tent mm-hmm. starts shaking, absolutely terrifying. I don't care what anyone says. That is one of the most terrifying scenes in any movie ever.
Yeah, no, the children and And the scene with all the like little fake cross things. And obviously, I mean, the last scene to me is just horrifying with all the handprints on the walls and stuff. Like, that's just terrifying. But I really like what they're able to do without showing anything. Like you hear the children and you're like, okay, like at first you do feel like when Josh showed, it's like, okay, this is gimmicky. Like, they had so little budget that they couldn't even put the noises in. And then they did. And then when you find out is when it comes to like the actual filmmaking behind this, they would literally set up their tent in the middle of the woods. And the directors would be like, okay, like, we'll like bother you later.
Yeah.
And so these people were so on edge because they didn't know when it was coming. They just knew something was coming. And then the directors would just show up and start shaking the tent and it would scare the shit out of them because they were really in the middle of the woods. Like, they really didn't know what was going on. And my thing is, so I ran cross country, grew up in New Jersey, which a lot of people might think like, oh, Jersey's like a lot of like city and stuff. But I grew up in the Pine Barrens area of New Jersey. A lot of trails, a lot of woods. And when you're running, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10 miles a day, you're looking for more trails and more woods. And every now and then you go down a trail and you're like, oh, that didn't lead anywhere. Let's turn on and go back. You can turn around and it's November and it's New Jersey and everything is just dead. And you're like, where do we go? Like, did we go right or did we go left? And you can't see a road and you can't hear cars and you can't, you're like, where am I right now? And you know that you're in your town, but at the same time, go watch the Sopranos episode where Paulie and Michael get lost in the Pine Barrens. They could have died out there. The Pine Barrens are massive in New Jersey. And I think that's where this is so scary for me, because I could envision myself being in one of these situations where it's just like, what do? Like, we're lost. Like, you got us lost. Like, we had been lost on runs before where you're like, if we go down this trail and then go that way and then go this way, we'll be fine. And then you're coming back. You're like, where was the fork and what did we do? And that trail doesn't look, it's not a fun feeling. It's not a fun feeling. And, you know, especially for days and days like this one is. Yeah, I mean, the psychosis starts to come in, but I just love that, like you said, the escalation. Mm-hmm. They start to show you new things every time. And even just the initial cemetery. We're going to the cemetery. They get to the cemetery. You're like, that's a little creepy. And then it just keeps going from there until finally you get to a house where there's just a bunch of children's hands. And you're like, okay, the witch made him stand in the corner. Fun times.
Yeah. I mean, that it has to be one of the best closing shots for a film ever. Because, again, because it's, you already know what's happening because it's explained at the very beginning of this movie. And then you just see Mike standing in the corner and you're like, oh, Heather's going to die right now.
Yep.
And then that's how it ends. And it's just like, it's not a jump scare to end it. It's just like, it ends.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so haunting because of that. And especially if you thought this was real and you thought that's actually what happened to these people, because that's what people thought in 1999.
Yeah, and I think that's the hardest thing to probably get back into people's minds with, is that's really what people thought had happened. Like, that's really, like, just keep reiterating, that's really what people thought had happened. That's frightening to think about. And there was no way, like, again, there was no way to prove it hadn't. And that's, I think, what the best thing with, think about like the classic horror movie, because this was a blockbuster. Yeah. Like, that's the craziest part. If you look up, what was the exact total that the Blair Witch Project made? I know it was insane. I'm going to look it up real quick because it really is.
I think it's like the third highest grossing movie when considering considering how much it was made for.
It made $1.5 million from 27 theaters in its opening weekend. It went on for a worldwide gross of $248.6 million, which was 4,000 times its original budget. $248.6 million, which was 400,000 times its original budget. Just think about that. So all of that, all that being said, think about some of the highest grossing movies in the history of film. A lot of them are horror movies. People don't really realize that. Mm-hmm. The Exorcist is the highest grossing R-rated movie ever, or it was until Deadpool, I think, came along and might have broke it. But Jaws, Psycho, The Exorcist, these movies made so much money. And it was all about the, you were hitting people where they could feel it. Psycho with the shower, Jaws with the ocean, The Exorcist with just being out of control, and you know, we're a Christian country. So that's terrifying. And the Blair Witch Project hits you in that place of, oh my God, we're really watching people die in the woods that are, you know, a large majority of America. And I think that's why it just worked. And not for nothing, think about what was coming in like the mid-2000s. How you started getting into like this snuff kind of stuff. The dark web. You could watch people get beheaded on the dark web. Like that was a thing you could do. There's always that weird fascination. You go back and watch the 1931 movie Freaks, which was all about carnies, and they want to turn the one lady so beautiful, they're going to turn her into a freak because she treats them like shit. Yeah. And it's people would pay money to come see these anomalies, these disgusting creatures, whatever. There's this weird feel of like, I'm going to go watch people die today. So I'm going to go see the movie. For some reason, there's a human interest in watching that, but it worked. And it hit people in an area where they could really feel it. And the Blair Witch Project, I mean, it stands the test of time. It's the same movie it was back then. The hardest part for this movie is when it was called the scariest movie ever. It's the same thing with The Exorcist. It's not the scariest movie ever, but it's damn scary. You just have to know what you're going into. You're not going to get you're not going to get any jump scares. There's no jump scares in the entire movie. It's all psychological. And is that the type of horror that gets you? Maybe, maybe not. But look into what this movie was doing. And it's the greatest marketed movie of all time. And it just works. I mean, the poster for the movie was literally missing. Heather Donahue, Josh Leonard, Michael Williams. Please call Frederick County Sheriff's Office with any information you may have. And it was just their headshots.
Yeah, like, it's brilliant. These actors were put on the lam while this movie was premiering. Like, they went all out to make people believe this movie actually happened. And what really did was it really showed studios the profitability of horror movies. Like you said, the most profitable movies of all time are pretty much horror movies. It's because they can be made cheaper and they rake in a lot of money because people love horror movies. That's why whenever you see like if we look at economical recessions, right? After like the 2008 recession, we kind of saw a resurgence in horror movies again. It's because it's cheaper to make them and they make a lot of money. Once everything kind of gets back at it after everything we've gone through in the last 2 years, we're going to see a resurgence of horror movies because they make a lot of money.
Well, and not for nothing. I mean, what were people doing at the beginning of COVID? They were all sitting down and watching Steven Soderbergh's Contagion. There's a there's a sickness to society. Like there just is. Like people are torturing themselves watching that movie being like, ha ha. Like, look, this is what's happening to us. It's like, so what's funny about what's happening to us? Like, I'm confused. But there's a sickness. There's a mental something that's going on. And the Blair Witch Project came at the perfect time. Y2K was going to end the world. You know, we're coming off the 90s where like things were so great, but then also like a lot of cities and stuff were in bad shape. And then the country wasn't exactly something super positive either. Like, you know, we're getting to the technology era, but we're not there yet. And there's still these hidden things going on in the world that are just scary. And Blair Witch just hit what people wanted. And it was really, to me, the Blair Witch Project is the first viral video ever. Yeah. It is a viral video. Like it was an 82-minute viral video. And you think about what came after that, all of the way that people started to, you know, what went viral, what went viral, what went viral. And it's all word of mouth. Half the stuff that goes viral isn't all that entertaining or that interesting or that scary or that anything. That was the Blair Witch Project. The Blair Witch Project was a viral video because of how it was marketed and because of what it was done. And I mean, it changed the game for how things were marketed and it changed the game for how this movie was or how movies and horror movies in particular were made for the next decade. And people are still trying to make found footage movies because they think that they can make a lot of money. And a lot of them did. Just none of them were ever as successful as this one.
No. I mean, it's hard to be successful as this one, right? You have if you look at it, there are like your pantheon, I think, of like found footage movies are the Blair Witch Project, Cloverfield, and Wreck. And then like maybe Paranormal Activity if you're like that. But that took
What was the third one?
Wreck.
I haven't seen that one.
Oh, it's a zombie movie.
Okay.
You remember Quarantine? Do you remember the movie Quarantine?
I remember Quarantine, yeah.
That was an American version of Wreck.
Oh, okay, got it. Yeah, Quarantine wasn't very good.
Yeah, Wreck much better. Yeah.
Okay.
And then, like, Paranormal Activity. But Paranormal Activity, you have to realize, only became big. Like, that, if you look on IMDb, it says that movie was made in 2000, or came out in 2007. Paranormal Activity was not wide released until 2009.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it just built up a reputation and then became popular as, like, yeah, the scariest movie ever made. And, like, it's the exact same thing the Blair Witch Project did, except it just did it in a different way, where Paranormal Activity had this, like, word of mouth. The Blair Witch Project just told you it was real.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, like, yeah, the Blair Witch Project isn't the first found footage film. It goes to Cannibal Holocaust.
I guess it wasn't found footage, but you had the documentary style with Man Bites Dog. I don't know if you ever saw that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, like, what the Blair Witch Project did for film, it's just unmatched. If you look, it's one of the most influential films of all time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's definitely one of the most influential films the last 30 years.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and you see Ty West, like, as somebody who likes to, you know, with The House of the Devil, yeah, and stuff like that, you see him start, you know, he delves into this a little bit. And I mean, I will say that I think the most impressive spin on this genre after the Blair Witch Project was the movie Searching with John Cho.
Yeah.
I thought that was a really impressive version of this. Like, to me, that's like a 4-star movie. It was creative. It got into it. Because what always ends up happening with these movies is it always hits a point where it's like, okay, why are they still filming? Yes. And I love in this movie when Heather says, it's all I have at this point. Like, it's keeping her sane to keep filming it. I buy that. She's losing her mind. She's so driven. She needs to hope that they're going to survive this and she's going to be able to show somebody this movie. But then a lot of times, like, you watch these other movies and you're like, why are you still filming? Where is that camera? What's going on with this? Like, that's where it starts to hurt. Cloverfield could even be considered one of those. Cloverfield's a great movie, don't get me wrong. But Cloverfield very much has, like, some moments where it's like, why are we still going with this? I'm like, put the damn camera away. And you hear all the time, put the camera away, put the camera away. I don't want to, you know. Blair Witch did that, but Blair Witch made sense when they kept going with it. There's so many movies where it's just like, okay, I get it. Like, you don't still need the camera to be going. So, I don't know. I love Blair Witch.
It just goes to the ingenuity of this movie, mm-hmm, is everything has a reason. Like, they took the time to set everything up and to give you the explanations you were going to have. The only thing I find that doesn't have an explanation, why they didn't just follow the goddamn river out of the forest.
Yeah, that was my biggest thing too. But then at the one point they end up coming back in a circle. So it's almost like at that point, are they just like ensnared? Yeah, are they ensnared by the Blair Witch? No, I agree. The river should be what takes you out. Just keep following it until it turns dry. Yeah. Don't tell anyone. You're gonna get out somewhere. But hey man, don't poke holes in your 33rd favorite movie of all time. Don't be an ass. No,
because you know what? Even that, you know what? You're not thinking logically at that point anyways. You're a couple days lost in the woods now. You're running out of food. It's crazy. The shit's happening at night. Who knows what's going on anymore? It's okay.
About to pass out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. What else do you have on this movie?
Watch it with the lights out.
Yeah, I agree.
It's a whole other experience. It really pays, like, There are scenes in the night where it's just like complete darkness before they turn on lights. And like it gives you chills when you watch this movie. It's just complete darkness.
Watch it at night. Watch it like before you're going to go to bed. Watch it when you're a little tired. It's only 82 minutes long. Like, don't watch it when your senses are at their highest. That you just really like, it just hits, man. It really does. Like, it just nails it across the board. And I don't know. Every time I watch it, like I said, I just sit there with a smile on my face. It doesn't scare me as much anymore because I've seen it so many times, but I can't help but smile every time I freaking watch it because I'm just like, man, what they were able to do with this is just so impressive. It really is just so impressive.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, next week we are going to our number 32s, which for John is Man with a Movie Camera. So congratulations. You're going to get to watch, what is it, 65 minutes of just a man like taking film of Russia, right?
Yeah, it's great. Yeah, it's fantastic.
And then my favorite Western of all time, which is Once Upon a Time in the West. My first movie from 1968, the first of four that are going to come up over the next 10 weeks. So I love 1968 to me is the greatest movie, the greatest top heavy year in movie history. Four movies in my top 32 movies of all time. That's pretty crazy. I mean, that's one eighth of my top 32 is 1968. We started off with Once Upon a Time in the West. Yeah, make sure you watch that where you can listen to it loud because the score is one of the greatest of all time. But yeah, Man with a Movie Camera, Once Upon a Time in the West. We'll be back again next week, maybe on Thursday or Friday or something. Me and John will figure it out. But thank you all for listening. Thank you all for tuning in. If you haven't joined the Discord group yet, join, become a patron for $1 and you can join the Discord group. We'll have conversations about movies and stuff. John spiced it up last week and he actually got two responses. I was impressed since people are still just learning about the Discord. So good job, John. I appreciate the effort. Everybody else, we'll see you next week.